Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Polls indicate that foreign policy is not a top priority for voters this year. Behind the economy, healthcare, and education, still it is important for presidential hopefuls to speak with authority on world affairs. Political analysts call it a gateway issue, allowing candidates to project strength and confidence. And so this year's presidential candidates have all weighed in on a huge array of foreign policy topics. Terrorism and the U.S. response to ISIS has been a major concern. Russia's increasingly aggressive posture on the world stage is another, as is the refugee crisis in Europe. Today in The Exchange, where the candidates stand on foreign policy, let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from New York City is Willis Sparks. He covers global politics for the Eurasia Group, a political risk consulting firm. And Willis, nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us, Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College and contributor to the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State. And Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Laura.
And with me in studio, Kirk Dorsey, professor of history and U.S. foreign policy at UNH. And Kirk, a welcome back to you, too. Thanks for
your
time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, all of you, I'll turn to you first. Kirk, what about this idea that foreign policy is a gateway issue, that without offering too much detail, candidates need to know, they look like they know what they're talking about, and project strength?
Absolutely. The presidency has one main job that is separate from everything else, which is to be the commander-in-chief of the armed forces and to be the person in charge of American diplomacy. Everything else gets run through Congress. But as we saw with the Iran deal, the president can pretty much do what he wants in terms of foreign policy, or she wants if Hillary Clinton gets elected. And commander-in-chief, you have almost unlimited power to do what you want. So voters who are paying attention want to see that they can trust these particular candidates with, on one hand, the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, and on the other hand, the lives of their 18-year-olds in small conflicts around the world. So they have to convince the American voters that they are trustworthy on these particular issues.
Wow. So this is the one area where the president, he or she, can exercise more authority. And yet the polls, I looked at a bunch of them yesterday, Kirk, show that voters put this, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 on their list of concerns.
Well, it's in day-to-day living for most Americans, it doesn't seem that relevant. But of course it is. All you have to do is look in the labels in the back of your shirts and see where they all come from. And
trade,
you can see
right.
That trade is really influential in how we live our lives and our standards of living. I was amazed at the debate last night at CNBC. Nobody talked about trade and dealing with China. But that's a matter of really basic foreign policy that does affect our lives day to day. But it's sort of insulated from us. It's similar with the way we offsource our pollution. You know, we import oil from other countries and we import manufactured goods from other countries. And we outsource our pollution and we just forget about it. And we don't think, well, we live in a clean society because there's pollution elsewhere in the world. So it's easy to forget about. And if the candidates don't force us to think about it, we think about the more immediate things that seem to, especially in economics.
Well, and sure, and we will talk about trade this hour. I did want to turn to you too, Wayne L'Esperance, on this idea that, you know, foreign policy, as Kirk is describing, is super important for a president, and yet voters kind of pay attention, maybe sort of, but not really.
Well, I think that's about right. And usually until a major crisis erupts. You remember when we had the discussions about Ebola during the last midterm election cycle, you know, certainly voters suddenly became much more keen and much more interested. I think one could argue that ISIS has also raised, more discussions among voters about what the appropriate role is for the United States. But you're right. In terms of the polling that we see, the domestic issues, jobs and the economy still are the number one issues out there. One argument that we're hearing is that as the economy, as the president says, is getting better, does this give opportunity for voters to begin to focus on other things as well? And certainly Republican candidates are trying to show how different they are, how different they would be as president than President Obama on areas of foreign policy. This is an area where it's very easy for them to articulate some real clear differences with the president and his administration.
Well, and it's a big field of candidates, as you know, Wayne, three Democrats and a dozen Republicans. And in this very large field, Wayne, there are some candidates with tons of foreign policy experience and some with absolutely none at all. How much does that matter, Wayne?
Well, if you ask Lindsey Graham, it should matter a heck of a lot. It doesn't seem to be the defining issue in terms of success with voters, or at least in polling data. So right now, it's not the variable, I think, that makes the big difference. And yet, you know, I think all of us would argue in our classes that the distinction between foreign and domestic policy is a really, really thin one, if it exists at all, as one of the guests just mentioned. So, you know, to the extent that we can convince fellow voters that they ought to be paying more attention to foreign policy, I think all of us ought to be doing that. And frankly, that kind of experience that we're going to hear, certainly we have heard from Hillary Clinton and from Lindsey Graham and others, ought to matter and you know, maybe will matter by the time we get to Election Day.
Willis Sparks, what do you make of all this? Again, as someone who is the head of a political risk consulting firm and looks at this and its importance, what do you make of this? It's important, but not that important, and yet it is important.
Well, whether it's important, whether the specifics are important or not, certainly the Republicans have calculated that it's smart for them to talk about foreign policy at the moment, because essentially they're running against both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton at the moment. Hillary Clinton's most recent job, of course, was as Secretary of State. So where do they perceive vulnerabilities for her? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of focus on Benghazi, but there are a lot of Republicans willing to talk about foreign policy because they feel there's a case that they can make that Barack Obama is weak, timid, indecisive, not projecting strength in the world. And while a lot of voters may not care about the specifics of foreign policy, what's going on in the South China Sea or in Syria, they care about America's ability to project strength as they perceive it in the world. Strong military, strong economy, America, the world's only superpower, able to project its influence throughout the world. I think, although you didn't hear about it a lot last night because the debate was mainly focused on economics, Republicans are going to keep hammering at foreign policy, even the ones who are less experienced in talking about the specifics.
So given that we have, Willis, a former Secretary of State running, has that elevated the role of foreign policy in this presidential year? What do you think?
Not on the Democratic side, because there are areas, you know, for Mrs. Clinton where there are subjects that she doesn't want to talk about for reasons that are particular to the Democratic field. She, you know, trade, we're going to come back to trade. She doesn't really want to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which she once called the gold standard of trade agreements, but which she's since walked away from because, frankly, it's not going to help her win the Democratic nomination. The Keystone XL pipeline is another issue that's very sensitive on the Democratic side, not a lot of controversy on the Republican side. So while the Republicans certainly have an interest in talking up various aspects of foreign policy, trying to portray President Obama as weak, trying to portray Hillary Clinton as simply an extension of that foreign policy, Democrats will, certainly Hillary Clinton, will try and focus more on domestic policy.
Again, our phone number for you to join us here in The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, foreign policy on the campaign trail. We're looking at what the candidates are saying about America's role in the world, from terrorism to trade. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What worldviews do you want to hear these candidates present? Which one appeals to you in terms of his or her approach to foreign policy? What do you think some of the most important foreign policy issues should be in this campaign? Again, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, with us now for a few minutes is NHPR's Jason Moon. He's been reporting on the Republicans' positions on foreign policy, so we'll focus in on that for a moment. Jason, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so Jason, in a primary, you'd expect similarities among candidates. They're from the same party, after all. So what are some of the broad general themes, Jason, that you're hearing from these Republican candidates?
Well, I think that's, as already has been pointed out, much of the general sense of the Republican field can be heard in the way they criticize the current administration. So things like a sort of indecisiveness in foreign policy, a sense of weakness or fecklessness, and in particular that is focused on how our relationship with our allies has changed over the last 8 years, particularly with respect to Israel. So I would say the general sense in the Republican primary field is that in foreign policy there needs to be a stronger hand on the wheel, and I think that's where most of them can agree.
That's a broad theme that you heard.
Absolutely.
When you reviewed all these candidates. Any sort of subtle fault lines, though, among these candidates? I mean, there's 12 or so people, so you are going to find some differences.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, but there is some difference, and some of it is significant. I would say there's two kinds of differences that you can find. One is in actual policy substance, and one area where that issue really shows up is in the issue of ISIS and what to do in Iraq and Syria. And one of the main questions in that issue is whether or not to put American troops on the ground. And in this question, while they all agree that more needs to be done, you do get some real difference in terms of whether or not we should commit American troops. And so if you can think of the Republican primary field as a sort of spectrum, on the one hand, Lindsey Graham, certainly the most hawkish, calling pretty unapologetically in no uncertain terms, rather, for American troops to go back to Iraq and into Syria. On the other side, you have someone like Rand Paul, who has made it pretty clear that he's not for that. So,
well, since you mentioned Senator Graham from South Carolina, he is known as having that perhaps most muscular position on ISIS, the U.S. role in Syria. Let's hear from Senator Graham.
If you're running for president of the United States and you don't understand that we need more American ground forces in Iraq and that America has to be part of a regional ground force that will go into Syria and destroy ISIL in Syria, then you're not ready to be commander-in-chief.
So boots on the ground, Jason, even though, you know, the Iraq war was still controversial and so forth, Senator Graham is saying, nope, this is what we need to do.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the subtext to this whole debate is the political history, especially within the Republican Party, in terms of military interventions in that region. And I think one of the takeaways here is that it's kind of remarkable how much things have moved in just the past couple of years. I mean, the idea of sending American troops back to the region just a few years ago wasn't really politically palatable, but foreign policy things move quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I remember when Ron Paul ran in his two campaigns, got huge cheers with his opposition to the Iraq war. His son Rand Paul also has adopted a similar foreign policy, less interventionist than a Lindsey Graham and some of the other candidates. Let's hear from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul.
Now, I'm not sending our sons and our daughters back to Iraq. The war didn't work. We can amplify those who live there. The Kurds deserve to be armed, and I'll arm them. We can use our Air Force to amplify the forces there, but the boots on the ground need to be the people who live there.
Okay, so again, that's Rand Paul, Senator of Kentucky, offering a different view. And Jason, just hang with us for a moment. I want to turn to you, Wayne L'Esperance. What do you think about this split in the Republican Party over how involved or not America should be in Syria and fighting ISIS?
Well, I'm not sure how much of a split it is. Certainly Rand Paul stands apart from many of the others. And really, with the others, it's a matter of degree. But he has been clear, as his father was, that, you know, not only would he not use boots on the ground there, but that any use of military force requires a, you know, congressional authorization. That gets, you know, a bit trickier. So it's consistent with his, you know, message about, you know, being a strict constructionist when it comes to the Constitution and wanting to limit executive power. But it's unprecedented to some extent in terms of what, you know, prior presidents have done. Others are clearly more comfortable with the use of force. And frankly, I think as somebody just said, their focus is really on the current administration and Secretary Clinton as having made the world less safe. And that their, I think somebody used this word too, feckless leadership on the world stage has led to, greater levels of threat from people like Putin and ISIS and other challengers. So, you know, Rand Paul sort of stands apart, but I'm not sure that the rest of the party is on the same page with him.
So the rest of the party, Wayne, is pretty much more in line with a Lindsey Graham, maybe not so specific in terms of boots on the ground, but more on that interventionist line.
Senator Graham's gone the farthest in terms of what he wants to do vis-a-vis ISIS, but I think they're all in the same ballpark.
Let's hear from another candidate who is topping some polls recently, and that's Ben Carson. Let's hear what Dr. Carson has to say about how the U.S. should fight ISIS.
I would use every resource available, military, banking, sanctions, you name it. And I would not hesitate to put boots on the ground. You know, we need to be the leaders. The coalition will form if it has a leader.
The coalition will form if it has a leader, Kirk. And this is a theme that I've heard, sort of Republicans versus Democrats. Democrats tend to say more, let's work with our allies, let's form a coalition, let's not necessarily head this coalition, but let's participate. Whereas Republicans tend to say, we need to lead on this thing.
Yeah, and I think when we get to the general election, we're going to see these kind of deep splits about how to handle it. Even within the Democratic debate, there's a little bit of a split between Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton about, say, a no-fly zone in Syria. But that's a long way from the Republican position that there needs to be leadership, that the United States has basically given up leadership in the Middle East and has backed away from its friends in Israel. And this is, of course, tied into the Iran deal, letting Iran build a nuclear weapon, as the Republicans conclude that the deal is. So they're all sort of connected. And I think that, you know, to come back to the question about the seriousness of foreign policy, the fact that Ben Carson and Donald Trump, who admittedly have no experience running anything close to a foreign policy, that they are soaring to the top, suggests that foreign policy just isn't that important to American voters. The Republicans want to hear the tough rhetoric, but they don't particularly care who's speaking the rhetoric. It doesn't matter to them that Ben Carson and Donald Trump really don't have any experience to back that rhetoric up.
Well, and Barack Obama had no foreign policy experience either when he was running for office, 2 years in the U.S. Senate and then some time in the legislature in Illinois.
He had the incredible good fortune not to have to vote on the Iraq War. And so he was able to position himself first
in the
primaries as the person who did not support the Iraq War against John Edwards and Hillary Clinton. And interestingly, Bernie Sanders, in his campaign material on foreign policy, says he's most proud of the fact that he opposed the Iraq War. So the history is not gone. We are still going to live through that debate, as Wayne said. You know, there's still this question about living through the Republican history.
Well, a lot more topics to cover: Russia, Iran, China, and we also need to look at the Democrats and their approach towards terrorism, ISIS, Syria. But Jason Moon, I do want to let you go. One last question, please. What jumped out at you, Jason, or surprised you from doing this very extensive look that you did at the Republican candidates on foreign policy?
I would say, even though it's not polling as a important issue to voters necessarily, I am surprised at the volume we're hearing about foreign policy from Republicans. Traditionally, it is a stronger issue for Republicans than Democrats, and they're certainly trying to capitalize on that a lot this primary season.
Okay, Jason, thank you for helping us out. That's NHPR's Jason Moon. Again, he's been following what Republican candidates have been saying this year on foreign policy. To see Jason's full report, go to nhpr.org and find Where They Stand. There's a lot of great information there. Thanks again, Jason. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Willis Sparks, to you, your take on this idea of, let's join a coalition. No, let's lead a coalition.
Well, you know, these are not specifics. Anyone can say, you know, if we build it, they will come. And, you know, we'll wait and see until somebody's president. I mean, I'm glad that we're having this conversation on New Hampshire Public Radio, because voters in New Hampshire are famous for asking tough questions on all sorts of issues. And I hope that in future town halls on foreign policy, you know, we'll have foreign policy questions such as, well, if you did put boots on the ground, if you did take out ISIS, what comes next? We took out the Taliban in Afghanistan. We beat back a surge in Iraq. The question is, how long do you keep the troops there to ensure that the next wave of jihadis doesn't simply step into the vacuum? Second, Mr. Carson talks about we need to use sanctions against ISIS. Well, exactly who or what are you sanctioning would be a good question. And for the Democrats or the Republicans talking about a no-fly zone in Syria, the President of the United States may have to decide, if you try to impose a no-fly zone in Syria, one of the questions that gets raised, do you shoot down a Russian plane that comes into Syrian airspace. These are the questions that presidents actually have to answer on a day-to-day basis, rather than generalities about sanctions and coalitions
and
the strength
so forth.
Of American leadership.
All right, we will be back after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a breakdown of foreign policy on the presidential campaign trail. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. What general world views do you hear these candidates presenting, and which appeals to you? What do you think the number one foreign policy issue should be during this presidential race? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Kirk Dorsey, professor of history and U.S. foreign policy at UNH, Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College, contributor to the forthcoming book, The New Islamic State, and Willis Sparks. He covers global politics for the Eurasia Group, a political risk consulting firm based in New York. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's talk about Russia. A couple of you mentioned it earlier in the hour, especially since Vladimir Putin is getting involved in the Syrian conflict. Willis, I'll turn to you first. What's the overall approach toward Putin that you hear from these candidates? And let's take the Republicans first.
I think that the Republicans are using Putin as a foil for President Obama to make the election a referendum on strength versus weakness. Putin makes for a great Bond villain. You know, he's slick. He's got that sly smile. He's aggressive. And so Republicans want to ask the fundamental question to voters: who do you want to have in the room looking this guy in the eye when we're next having a conversation with Russia? But the better questions may be, well, yes, the Russians are in Crimea. They're probably not leaving. What should the U.S. president do about that? What should the U.S. president do about Russia's long-term ability to destabilize Ukraine? Should the Russians have a role in the Middle East? If so, what would that be? I think it's another example of a place where the candidates running for president are trying to make this into a simple referendum on strength versus weakness, when the actual foreign policy challenges are much more complicated and nuanced than that.
So broad statements showing strength, and that's fine. You expect that. You'd like to hear a little bit more of the okay, then what, Willis? That's what I'm hearing from you.
I think that the American people deserve that, because I think the next president of the United States will be dealing with exactly those challenges. And while voters may not see the relevance to those issues in their daily lives immediately, I don't think it's difficult for a candidate who wanted to do it to make a very quick 2-minute case going around the world about China, Russia, Middle East, Europe, and a lot of other issues besides, will make a difference in peace and prosperity for Americans in years to come.
Well, Carly Fiorina was asked about Vladimir Putin, how she would handle him, how she would talk to him. Carly Fiorina says she wouldn't talk to Vladimir Putin.
Having yes. met Vladimir Putin, I wouldn't talk to him at all. We've talked way too much to him. What I would do immediately is begin rebuilding the Sixth Fleet. I would begin rebuilding the missile defense program in Poland. I would conduct regular, aggressive military exercises in the Baltic states. I'd probably send a few thousand more troops into Germany. Vladimir Putin would get the message.
Again, that's Republican candidate Carly Fiorina. So Wayne L'Esperance, she's giving that specificity that that Willis is talking about.
That's right. I mean, I think that's much better than the answer that we got from Ben Carson, for example, who basically said all options are on the table. Well, what does that mean? I mean, exactly. Are you suggesting that we would physically intervene to try to push the Russians out of Ukraine or Crimea or whatever it is? I mean, you know, I think the point that was just made, that these issues are complex, they're not easily to resolve, lends itself to sort of bumper sticker answers and posturing about toughness that really bear little resemblance to, you know, just how tough of an issue these things are. And frankly, no candidate wants to go on the record calling for very specific action vis-a-vis Putin when the reality is that they get elected, people are going to wonder why they didn't actually do those things. So I think that they're safe, they're playing it safe, and by pivoting and pointing out at the president and by extension Secretary Clinton really caused this trouble, you know, that's safe territory for them. Not sure it does a whole lot of justice to voters in terms of they're making their minds up, but I think it explains it. You know, just really quickly, Laura, Secretary Clinton has also had very tough language on Russia as well. At one point in one speech, he compared the annexation of Crimea to, you know, Nazi Germany. So it's not just Republicans that are talking tough. Certainly Secretary Clinton has as well on this particular issue.
Kirk, what do you think about what Wayne says, that it's tricky to get too specific because these foreign affairs events are quite fluid. So if you nail yourself down to something in particular, you might get in trouble later when things change.
Absolutely. I would love to see specifics, too. But there's no reward for the candidates to be specific. It doesn't. It boxes them in terms of when they become actual, if they actually become the nominee or actually, God forbid, become president, then they suddenly are on record as having said what I will do to Putin. And who knows what's going to happen 2 years from now whenever they're eventually sworn in. So there's no particular benefit to being specific. In addition, we don't really know what the foreign policy crises are going to be in January of 2017. When the American people elected George Bush in 2000 on, you know, talking about a humble foreign policy, no one really anticipated how 9/11 would change the world. So in many ways, it pays off for the candidate to be general and say, this is the kind of candidate I am. And this is why I think why Donald Trump is getting away with it. Really no specifics in foreign policy. You go to his webpage, he's got nothing on foreign policy to speak of, far less than any other candidate. But he's presenting an image that he is a tough negotiator. So it doesn't really matter what the problem is. It doesn't matter if it's Putin or somebody in China or somebody in Japan. He will be, or Mexico, obviously, he will be able to negotiate with that person, and he won't be the weak leader that we've had, as he says, in Obama and Secretary Clinton. So in that sense, he's got no reason to be specific. He needs to just project an image of strength and reliability. The other thing I think is fascinating is that all the Republicans are in lockstep about rebuilding the military, that this seems to be the one thing they all agree on, except maybe Senator Paul. But there's no, again, there's no specifics like the Army can't meet its recruiting goals now. How are we going to rebuild the military if we can't even recruit for the smaller military we have now? So this, you know, these specifics need to be addressed, but they don't get any reward for addressing these.
Yeah, that's, again, one of those follow-ups that Willis keeps saying he wants to hear, and that's a good one, too. So rebuild the military. Okay, what's the next step there?
And the other aspect of that, just very quickly, is, you know, a lot of the issue on military spending is the sequester, which Republicans and Democrats share responsibility on. So it's always going to be easy to say, spend more money on the military. We need to have the world's strongest military. But the reasons that we have cut military spending are far more complex than any of the candidates are acknowledging.
Well, and since all of you mentioned Hillary Clinton and her position on Russia and its engagement in Syria, which has caused a lot of concern in the Obama administration, let's hear from Hillary Clinton on the need to engage with Russia in a strategy for this Syrian conflict.
There's no doubt that when Putin came back in and said he was going to be president, that did change the relationship. We have to stand up to his bullying, and specifically in Syria, it is important, and I applaud the administration because they are engaged in talks right now with the Russians to make it clear that they've got to be part of the solution to try to end that bloody conflict.
Again, that's Hillary Clinton talking about Russia since it has started engaging in Syria. We hear that word a lot, Wayne L'Esperance, when it comes to Vladimir Putin, bully. I think I heard that 10 times yesterday getting ready for this show.
Right. I mean, as was said, much more eloquently than I could say it, he is a perfect Bond villain. I mean, he kind of appeals to all the sort of bad guy images that we love in those kinds of movies, I suppose. But you know, so that's it. I really think that, you know, someone has to sort of raise their hand and say, okay, but why should Vladimir Putin care what the U.S. is saying to him at this point? We've demonstrated no willingness, really, to aggressively hold his feet to the fire on anything that he's been doing recently. So, you know, and at least one Republican, you know, Trump, has sort of said that, look, you know, if Putin wants to go in there and fight ISIS, if he wants to go in there and deal with them, why do we care? Let him go do it. So there's at least a mixed bag. I think a lot of world leaders are looking ahead, trying to figure out who's going to be the next president of the United States, and that's going to become their focus. What President Obama does at this point, there's very little ability for him to affect, I think, significant change in our relationship with Russia.
You know, two things about the
Russian
approach to Putin. You know, she's really the only candidate on either side that has a vulnerability related to Putin, because she is associated fairly and unfairly with the Obama administration's quote-unquote reset of relations with Russia, which Republicans are using to suggest the naivete of the Obama approach to him. That's why you hear Hillary Clinton talking about the moment when Putin return to the presidency. It's her way of deflecting charges that she was part of that naive approach in the beginning by saying, well, things have changed since then. The other issue is she is certainly the most nuanced, because what she's suggesting is, yeah, there are certain ways in which we have to stand up to Putin. There are also certain ways in which we can use Putin, particularly in Syria. So let's have a multifaceted approach to foreign policy. Let's stand up to him where we need to. And if he, as was said, if he wants to go in and drop bombs on some of the people that we'd like to see bombed in Syria, let him pay for it. Let him take the costs and risks.
Right. Well, since one of you mentioned, I think it was you, Wayne, Donald Trump and his approach toward this Russia, Syria, this whole sort of what Bernie Sanders actually calls a quagmire within a quagmire. Let's hear Donald Trump's thoughts on whether the U.S. should hold off before taking action there.
So you have ISIS that wants to take on Assad. So we're fighting ISIS, but we want to fight Assad. Why don't you let those two fight for a little while and take over the remnants?
Again, that's Donald Trump talking about foreign policy, ISIS, Russia, Syria. The exchange number for you to join our conversation as we look at what the candidates are saying about foreign policy this year is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You know, gentlemen, we've been talking a lot about the Republicans and what they have to say about these foreign policy crises. Again, there's many more Republicans than there are Democrats. But what about the Democrats, Kirk Dorsey? How are Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders talking about this situation in Syria and its spreading to the whole Middle East, really?
Well, I was kind of amazed to see Martin O'Malley invoking John Quincy Adams in his famous speech from 1821, "We go not abroad in search of monsters to destroy," suggesting that if anything, the Obama administration might have been too aggressive. And I think Bernie Sanders has suggested some of the same things, that they have it in a way in a unique situation because they're running against the Secretary of State from the sitting administration. And so, but it's also within their party. So they have to be careful not to criticize too much because they are still loyal to their leader, Barack Obama. But at the same time, they want to suggest why they would be better stewards of American foreign policy than Hillary Clinton. So when Clinton, who is the only candidate in the race with real actual foreign policy credentials, displays nuance, that's not surprising. Once you're in the office, I mean, this is one of the things that happens, I think, probably universally in American history. You get people without a lot of foreign policy experience campaigning on these very black and white issues, and then they get in office and they realize
it's complicated.
It's way more complicated than at least they said on the campaign trail. Maybe they recognized that beforehand, but certainly they didn't campaign that way. And so if you've been Secretary of State, I think it's a lot harder to talk black and white and not just sort of strangle yourself on your words, knowing that you've seen what you've seen about how the gray area is so important. So Sanders and O'Malley have the ability to sort of do a little more of the black and white worldview, and they are on the non-interventionist, I wouldn't quite say isolationist, but the non-interventionist side, that the United States, if anything, has intervened too much and should let other people solve their problems around the world.
Well, and I want to give listeners a flavor of what you talk about, that non-interventionist side. Here's Bernie Sanders in the Democratic debate describing the situation in Syria as a quagmire within a quagmire and relating it to his experience as head of the Senate Veterans Committee.
I learned a very powerful lesson about the cost of war. And I will do everything that I can to make sure that the United States does not get involved in another quagmire like we did in Iraq, the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of this country. We should be putting together a coalition of Arab countries who should be leading the effort. We should be supportive. But I do not support American ground troops in Syria.
So again, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Democratic presidential candidate, describing Willis Sparks, a very different foreign policy than what we heard from Ben Carson and Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, absolutely. But well within the Democratic tradition. I was a little surprised he didn't mention Vietnam when he started talking about, you know, avoiding historic quagmires. I guess Iraq is an easier call to make for a lot of younger voters. But, you know, I think that what you see from Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders is the same foreign policy approach that you see on other issues. They're trying to differentiate themselves from Hillary Clinton without necessarily attacking her. Part of that is just the reality of their positions within the race, the likelihood that she will be the nominee, and wanting to continue to let their voices be heard beyond the counting of the delegates next summer. And, you know, part of it is the fact that there is a tradition in the Democratic Party of being much more skeptical of the traditional hawkish view of foreign policy. I think you hear that as well.
What do you think, Wayne?
No, I agree. I mean, to some extent, it shows the difference, as somebody said, you know, between Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley and the president and Secretary Clinton. Certainly, you know, there is a strong view among progressives that, you know, the U.S. is engaged in adventurism and that you know, Iraq is an example of what is worst about American foreign policy when it's misapplied. You know, it remains to be seen whether, you know, independents and others and you know, more conservative or moderate Democrats will agree with that. And certainly as the conversation evolves on ISIS, there seems to be growing support for doing something more than what we're currently doing. And President Obama's team is looking at that. We heard Ashton Carter talk about the introduction of more forward controllers in U.S. Special Operations Forces to carry out more attacks and raids like we just saw this past week to rescue those hostages being held by ISIS. So there is a real distinction there, and I guess we'll see how this plays with voters over the time.
Okay,
the one thing that
yeah,
I think
go ahead,
is untrue on both sides, on the Democratic and the Republican side, is there is an identifiable segment of voters that are looking at Syria saying, if you can't explain that conflict to me, why should we commit troops and taxpayer dollars there? That's why Donald Trump gets laughter and applause when he says, wait, we hate all these people, why not let them fight one another? You know, everyone... That sounds very commonsensical to people who think this is an eight-sided conflict and we don't really like any of these sides. What
yeah,
exactly
which side
are
we get
trying
in
to accomplish?
Kirk, go ahead.
Well, I also wanted to add that, of course, the Afghanistan issue is still out there. And Barack Obama basically promised that we'd be out of Afghanistan. And now recently he said, well, we're not during my watch. There will still be American troops on the ground in Afghanistan. And so I think that's something that is going to come up as an issue as well. You know, the progressive desire for the United States to get out of Iraq and get out of Afghanistan when Barack Obama was elected. Well, we got out of Iraq, but now we're going back in, and there's just a soldier killed in Iraq, and now we have Americans still on the ground in Afghanistan, and they're not going to be out anytime soon. The next president will have to decide what happens. You know, Kunduz just got captured, and there was that huge battle. So at a certain level, I think that Hillary Clinton is, no matter what she does to distance herself, will be associated with that policy. And so
the shifts in that policy.
And so the progressive left, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley want to suggest, well, actually, you know, we didn't get what we were promised on Afghanistan. And again, they have to be careful. They can't criticize Barack Obama directly. But at the same time, they want in the primary to suggest that they would have done something differently. And we would have just washed our hands of Afghanistan and admitted it was a defeat. And of course, the other reason they can't say Vietnam was the worst defeat is Lyndon Johnson's defeat. they don't want to tag it
president.
To the Democrats. So tagging on George W. Bush is a lot more palatable.
Let's hear from our listeners, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Alex is calling from Rochester. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is mostly in regards to the misperception of Bernie Sanders as a quote-unquote peace candidate. He's not a pacifist, and he's repeatedly gone on the record stating he's not a pacifist. And in regards to Syria, like at the CNN debate on October 13th, he said that he supports President Obama in U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria. He also said that on the PBS NewsHour back in May of this year. So he's not a warmonger, but he's not against war. So
okay.
I just thought I'd add that.
Alex, thank you very much for calling in. So, Kirk, Bernie Sanders' position, not a complete hands-off, but supporting some activity, but not as deeply engaged as a Lindsey Graham or a Ben Carson or some of the other candidates.
Exactly. I don't think there's been any serious candidate who would be espousing pacifism. I don't think that would just play in the world. Even people who are skeptical after what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan still don't think that pacifism is the way to go in the world, generally. So I don't think Sanders is that way, but there's no doubt that he is much less likely to use military force, I think, than anybody else who's a plausible presidential candidate. Anybody who we might potentially see in the White House, I think he's much less likely to think that force is the answer. And this is what he's saying in his campaign literature as well, that it's not that we're opposed to using force, but force should be the last resort.
Okay. Well, Alex, thank you for the call. And we'll take more of your phone calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk trade, the Iran deal, and China. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the foreign policies of presidential candidates this year. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. What worldviews do you hear this year's presidential candidates talking about? Which worldviews appeal to you, which do not? And what do you think should be the number one foreign policy issue in this election year? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Kirk Dorsey, Wayne L'Esperance, Willis Sparks, let's talk about China. This keeps coming up in this presidential campaign. Willis, what are some of the themes that you're hearing these candidates talk about when they talk about China?
It's not so different, really, from the way they talk about Russia, because China engenders a different kind of fear that goes beyond the traditional security policy fears that we have with Russia. I think that voters are aware that there is a kind of mutually assured economic destruction in the relationship now based on the mutual dependence between the two countries. At the same time, the system, the Chinese system and Chinese political values are obviously quite different from American values. So for Republicans, I think it's an extension of the aren't we going to be tough and stand up when the bullies are acting in the South China Sea, China building artificial islands, claiming territory that is disputed by some of the other countries in the region. Some of them are U.S. allies. And won't we stand up to China on trade issues and on cyberspace issues? And it really becomes another referendum on the toughness and strength of the president. I do think on the Democratic side, really from both Secretary Clinton and from Bernie Sanders, you hear a much more realism about what a complicated problem China actually is, because there are certain ways in which we are different, and the U.S. does have to take a very tough stance on certain issues, while at the same time acknowledging that the economic reality is we're going to sink or swim together in the global economy over the next few years.
Yeah, Kirk, this is right up your alley, too. Trade and the importance of that economic relationship with China, it's huge.
It's huge, and I think that the thing to keep in mind is, as I said at the beginning, you know, the president can do what he or she wants in terms of foreign policy, but I should have added the caveat, except that the other countries aren't going to cooperate. Just like whatever.
And they have to deal with Congress, but
yeah, Congress might be easier to deal with than the Chinese leadership. And the problem with any president is you can lay out a framework for what you're going to do in the world, but the Chinese are calculating their own national interest, and they have calculated their national interest in the South China Sea, as they don't really care what the rest of the people in the South China Sea think. And this incident recently with the guided missile destroyer that the Obama administration sent right past one of the reefs they've been building is a direct challenge to Chinese definition of their national security, but it's a reinforcement of the American vision of basically free seas and free trade, which goes way back to, you know, the model treaty from John Adams, that people should be able to move across the seas freely and trade wherever they want. And the idea of closing off areas is not acceptable. So there's a deep American history here, but it's really fraught with difficulty. We don't know exactly what the line is where the Chinese are going to say enough. And they're sending us lots of warnings, you know, and thinking historically, they sent us lots of warnings in October of 1950 in the Korean War, and the Americans completely misread what those warnings were. Now, I don't think it's obviously not the same leadership. It's not right after the Chinese Revolution, but still, you have to have somebody in the White House who has the ability to understand the nuances of what China is talking about and has enough experience dealing with Chinese leaders that they understand when the warnings are for domestic consumption and when they are real warnings. And then even if they're real warnings, what is the value for the United States of challenging those warnings?
Well, I'm glad you brought in that past example, spoken like a history professor, Kirk. But when it comes to China, and, you know, you're saying the U.S. can say whatever it wants, but China's going to do whatever it wants.
Well, every leadership group in a country is calculating its national interest. And so they're calculating against the Americans as well. So, you know, one of the benefits for – and one of the good things about the Republicans, the way in which they're talking about a tough line, is they're also sending messages, maybe not intentionally, but to the Chinese government, that actually they are more likely to stand up to the Chinese militarily. So the Chinese are also trying to read the American political leadership and try to gauge what they can get away with, because they don't want a war either. I mean, nobody wants a war out of this. The trade relationship alone is too valuable to risk a war. Plus, war is rolling the dice. You never know when you're going to get boxcars instead of a 7. And so suddenly you lost and you thought you were going to win. So nobody wants a war out of this, but people have miscalculated their way into wars pretty frequently in world history. And so you don't want to stay as far away from it as possible. And I think in this case, it's important to be clear on both sides what your boundary lines are. But if you're just talking – so tough talk is good, but if it's backed up with a behind-the-scenes messages that we are serious about these things. And so you're going to have to make some calculations on your own.
Well, and since we're talking about trade and the importance of that economic relationship with China, Wayne Lesperance, trade is a foreign policy issue more salient in the Democratic race, right?
I would say so. You know, until and unless Republicans, and some of them are doing this, make the connection between trade and jobs, right? And that's how you get folks to pay attention to this, because, you know, a lot of the debate around, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has to do with the amount of wealth that will bring to the United States and the other partners, and what kind of jobs that might create, from the Democratic point of view, what kind of jobs that would cost Americans that would go overseas. So, you know, that's where trade becomes very important. You know, China is in the broader sense, absolutely key to all of the U.S. interests, trade and otherwise, in the Pacific, and managing that relationship is key. Hillary Clinton referred to China as the most important bilateral relationship the United States has. I don't think that's overstatement. I think that's absolutely true. So whether we're talking about, you know, rebuilding the Navy, adding ships to our surface warfare fleet, whether we're talking about our relationship with North Korea, managing Japan, which is now making interesting changes to allow the Japanese military to do more than they've done in recent memory. All of these things connect back to China, and managing that relationship is huge. One thing nobody's mentioned is cybersecurity, and George Pataki, as an example, has been speaking out quite a bit about this on the campaign trail as a major concern, as something that we ought to be more focused on, because China's at least alleged to be engaged in, you know, significant hacking of U.S. corporations and U.S. Government websites, which ought to be a source of concern. So this relationship is incredibly complex. It's incredibly difficult, and the cost of mismanaging it are very high.
Willis, I'd love to hear from you quickly on this, too.
Yeah, 2 points. First of all, I think that when Hillary Clinton says it's the most important bilateral relationship, it doesn't assume that we're going to be allies, rivals, enemies, friends. It's simply an important relationship in all of its facets. And I think that, you know, when we talk about trade, and we'll just use the Trans-Pacific Partnership as a good example, obviously that has domestic policy implications for jobs, has been said absolutely right. It's not just about the strength of the U.S. economy. It also has a security dimension, because the U.S. recognizes, and Secretary Clinton talked about this a lot when she was in the Obama administration, that there are a lot of China's neighbors that are extremely nervous about becoming overly reliant on China economically and what political and security dimensions that might have on them over time. So by signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, on the one hand, you're also strengthening your relationship with a lot of those countries, establishing the U.S. as a longer-term presence in the region, and you're also giving the Chinese arguably more incentive to make their own side trade and investment agreements with the U.S. Very quickly on cyber, when Xi Jinping was in Washington just a few weeks ago, there was an agreement, you know, an understanding between the two countries that they're not going to engage in this kind of corporate espionage. But I think we have to be realistic about that. We've had these, you know, agreements not to spy throughout time, even long before we talked about cyberspace. And I think it is, you know, it's a fundamental fact of life in the world that everybody's spying on everybody. When we move beyond corporate espionage and get into security matters, that's where I think the cyber issue becomes most concerning, because we don't know yet what the offensive and defensive capabilities of the world's most powerful states are in cyberspace. And let's hope that we don't find out by stumbling into conflict.
Again, our number for you to join us here in the exchange as we look at the foreign policy positions of this year's presidential candidates, Republicans and Democrats, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Gentlemen, here's an email from Judy in Canterbury, who says the candidates have been vociferous about potential Iranian nuclear weapons. Yet, Judy says, at the same time, Congress and the Obama administration are backing a $1 trillion plan for an entire new generation of U.S. nuclear weapons. Where do the candidates stand on this plan? Judy, thank you for the question. Wayne, to the second half of her question about an entire new generation of U.S. nuclear weapons, have you heard anything about this?
I can't say that I have.
Heard them talk about it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard much about that. I don't know if the other guests have.
No, Kirk, you?
I have not heard about that at all. No.
I haven't, but I do think that the guest makes an important point, which is that in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which a lot of countries signed, guaranteeing that they would not pursue nuclear weapons in the future, which Iran has violated in the past. It was also true that there's an understanding in that treaty that the powers that already had nuclear weapons would take steps to make them obsolete over time. And while the number of warheads has certainly been reduced since the end of the Cold War, I think there are a lot of countries out there that are very skeptical that the countries that have nuclear weapons are doing enough to make them beyond use.
Well, Judy, thank you for the email. And again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org. And since she started her email with the candidates talking about the Iran nuclear deal, let's talk about that, guys, and start off by hearing from Texas Senator Ted Cruz. He's a strong critic of this U.S.-Iran nuclear deal.
You better believe it. If I am elected president on the very first day in office, I will rip to shreds this catastrophic Iranian nuclear deal.
So there's Senator Cruz. Kirk Dorsey definitely saying he does not like this nuclear deal. What is it that a lot of Republican contenders this year don't like about it?
Well, it's closely tied to the idea of support for Israel and the idea that Iranian leaders in the past have suggested Israel doesn't have a right to exist. And so if Iran has a nuclear weapon, what's to stop Iran from using the nuclear weapon against Israel? The logical thing would be the fact that Israel has more nuclear weapons than Iran. That would be the logical thing that would stop them. But, of course, there's also an assumption in this that Iran is not logical, that Iran will not simply be deterred by Israel's nuclear deterrent. And so there's that combination, as well as a sense, again, this is about weakness and strength, that the Barack Obama administration backpedaled on this idea of keeping Iran from getting a nuclear weapons, and that they basically didn't maintain a position of strength, so they were sort of compelled to make this bad deal. And so we can rip it up and start over, which is largely fiction as far as I can tell, because there's nobody else in the world who would back up the President Cruz or any other president tearing apart this deal. It would be up to the United States almost single-handedly to try to keep Iran from getting a weapon. So I think it's one of those things that on the campaign trail, it's great red meat fodder. You toss it out to the audience. They love it. You're telling how weak Barack Obama is. But if any of these people are elected president, I think they're going to find it's very hard to replace that deal with anything else.
So it's a global, it's an international deal. There's other countries
right.
involved.
I mean, it all hinged on sanctions against Iran, and that the sanctions made Iran have to come to the negotiating table, and that Iran would basically give up its nuclear program to get the sanctions lifted, which is basically the deal they cut. I mean, it's much more complex than that. But the sanctions require cooperation from all the other powers that have the veto in the Security Council, but also the major trading partners. And they've all basically said this is a deal we're happy with. So if the United States backs away, it's going to be alone with almost no leverage.
Well, go ahead, Wayne.
Sorry, that's really the critical point. It's fine to point out, you know, the flaws with the deal and to say that, you know, the president didn't negotiate. Trump said it's the most incompletely negotiated treaty he's ever seen or deal he's ever seen. But the reality is that, okay, so what's the alternative? And as was just said, if, you know, our allies are not on board to continue sanctions indefinitely, so in that context, you know, some deal is better than no deal, and you know, that's the reality. And none of the Republicans have really offered the alternatives other than talking tough and thumping their chest. I do think the other point that was made is really key. This is as much a litmus test as how closely you're going to stand with Israel as it is about how tough you're going to be with Iran.
Well, and let's hear from another Republican candidate who had a different take from Senator Cruz. This is, again, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul responding to Ted Cruz's statement that he would rip it up on day one.
You know, Planned Parenthood has serviced this community for over 18 years without incident.
Okay, and that is clearly not the right cut. We're not talking about domestic policy this hour. We're talking about foreign policy and the Iran deal. Willis Sparks, am I correct in saying that all the Democrats, the three of them, all support this Iran deal?
I think that they support it to different degrees because, as has mentioned earlier, you know, Israel is the subtext here and its monopoly on nuclear weapons in the Middle East. So I think that everyone is going to approach this carefully. I don't know what Rand Paul was going to say exactly there, but I can guess that he might have pointed out to Mr. Cruz that, you know, the alternative might end up being war with Iran. It's very easy on the campaign trail to say Iran is bad, Iran is evil, we should never trust them. Fair enough. At the same time, to be even more specific, you know, to name names, the other parties to the agreement include Russia and China, who are you can't expect to uphold sanctions indefinitely. But even the other interlocutors at the table, The British, the French, and the Germans are in favor of this deal. So you're not just going to lose countries like Russia and China by tearing this up. You're also going to lose your allies. I think the larger point here, this is another example where a candidate has gone for low-hanging fruit that they know is going to play very well in the room that they're speaking in, that doesn't really address the realities that the next president of the United States will have to address.
Well, let's hear now what Senator Paul says about the Iran nuclear deal.
Should we continue to talk with Iran? Yes. Should we cut up the agreement immediately? That's absurd. Wouldn't you want to know if they've complied? Now, I'm going to vote against the agreement because I don't think there's significant leverage. But it doesn't mean that I would immediately not look at the agreement and cut it up without looking to see whether Iran is complying.
Again, the Iran nuclear deal, China, Russia, ISIS, all the topics that we're covering today in the exchange as we look at where the candidates stand on foreign policy. And gentlemen, we had a caller who couldn't stay on, but made this point, and I want to share it with you. He said he feels that Republicans are unfairly being called hawks when major wars have occurred under Democratic presidents. And Kirk, you're our history professor. I'll turn to you. Fair point?
Well, I mean, it depends how far back you're going to go. So I remember Bob Dole made that point when he was the vice presidential nominee.
That's right.
In 1976. Democrat wars, talking about Vietnam and Korea. And, you know, if we had elected Richard Nixon instead of John F. Kennedy in 1960, I'm skeptical that Nixon would have managed to find a way to stay out of Vietnam. And certainly in 68, Nixon was able to go deeper into that. And let's face it, the last couple of wars we've had, the war, both of which were with Iraq and were wars of choice, not requirements, were under Bush presidencies who were Republican. So I think frequently what happens is it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. You're operating within sort of a constrained set of choices, and you get into office and you have to protect what your perception is American credibility and American strength, and so you choose war. I don't think it's a Democratic or Republican issue.
Okay, well, I want to thank that person for sharing that comment. Willis Sparks, very quickly with you, in reviewing this long list of topics for today and all the topics we've covered, I haven't heard these presidential candidates say much about two huge continents, Latin America and Africa. Why not, Willis?
Well, they're pretty peaceful neighborhoods, generally. If you're talking about Latin America, only Colombia and Venezuela periodically shake their fists at one another. Sub-Saharan Africa includes so many different countries and so many complex issues that they don't lend themselves well to campaign soundbites. It is absolutely true that these regions are going to be important for the global economy and therefore for the United States in coming years. But I think in terms of the hotspots that candidates are naturally going to be drawn to, of course they're going to talk about the Middle East and China and Russia before anything else.
All right. All of you, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Kirk Dorsey, Wayne Lesperance, Willis Sparks, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.